From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
Australia's universities have been hard hit by the coronavirus crisis, with students unable to return to campuses and a huge drop-off in the enrolments of international students. There's been very limited government support for the sector, and until international travel can resume, it will be in dire straits. Meanwhile, the government has unveiled controversial legislation to change the fee structure for courses. Professor Barney Glover has long been a strong voice in the higher education sector and was formerly chair of Universities Australia, the peak body for the sector. He's the Vice-Chancellor of the Western Sydney University, which has a substantial proportion of students from disadvantaged backgrounds. His long career as a university executive has been marked by his focus on technology-based learning. Amongst his many roles on advisory committees, he's on the New South Wales International Education Advisory Board. Barney Glover joins us today to discuss how universities and their students have been affected by COVID and the path ahead. Barney Glover, your students have just returned from the midterm break. What does your campus look like? Are the many students actually on the premises, or is most of the teaching being done remotely?
Michelle, it's, I think like most Australian universities, we're taking a cautious approach to return to campus arrangements. We have a very extensive plan in place for a gradual return. Our campuses at the moment are remarkably quiet. We're running at about 15% capacity on most of our campuses in Western Sydney in terms of staff numbers. Students on campus are here largely for library, study hall opportunities to use technology because they might have difficulties at home accessing Wi-Fi and so on. And of course, they're in laboratories and simulations and practical classes and so on, things we can't easily replicate online and in a very appropriate socially distanced way. But no, it's a very quiet environment. We look to hopefully, if in New South Wales the pandemic stays well under control, we'll be increasing that to about 30% capacity in October and build towards 50% later in the year. So it's going to be a very gradual return. I think that's being replicated pretty well right across the sector.
So in the longer term, how different do you think the higher education model will look after the virus? Because even before this, universities were moving towards a good deal of remote learning.
We certainly had the balance, I think, emerging in the sector. Universities that were doing a certain amount of online delivery, universities, of course, very committed to their on-campus student experience. What characterised the response to the pandemic across the sector was just how rapidly universities were able to respond. Now, we are predominantly an on-campus institution. We don't have a large online component, but yet within 2 weeks, we transitioned 98% of our courses and programs substantially online. And that's a remarkable achievement. And then over the next 2 or 3 weeks, did an extraordinary amount of professional development for our staff in using the technology and understanding best practice in online delivery using things like Zoom and other platforms. So it's been an extraordinary transition and a great deal of challenge for our staff, our academic staff in particular, right at the front line of that delivery and what they have had to endure because they're working from home, often in carer responsibilities, a lot of challenge around suddenly working in that environment and to manage all of the complexities of that. So I'm incredibly grateful, I know every Vice Chancellor is, of the enormous amount of work that our academic and professional staff have put into the transition. But coming out of it now, even though we are still substantially online and will be this semester, we've had more chance to prepare for that. There are many things about the last few months that we've learned about our capacity for more hybrid delivery than we've had in the past, to provide more opportunities for students to both engage in a classroom environment, but also to use technology when that's appropriate to come into that classroom remotely and have a quality interactive experience. So what we'll see, I'm sure, in the future is an increasing amount of hybrid delivery. We're a multi-campus institution, so we want to stop people moving between campuses on the motorways of Sydney, and we want to see much more connectivity. Zoom has proven to be a very, very robust platform for us as it has for many. There are other video conferencing technologies being used that are equally robust. That gives us confidence now that we can do things differently. And the other thing I think we'll find very different in the future is the amount of flexible working from home arrangements that staff want to take up, particularly many of our professional staff, to spend some time working at home during the week. We know they can do that well because of the last few months. We're trialling a 12-month trial around flexible working from home arrangements. So we're going to see a different sector without a doubt. The other dimension that we could tease out, of course, is what is it going to mean for our international relationships, which we've been managing much more effectively using video conferencing technology in the future. I think it will add another dimension to our international partnerships. So the sector here in Australia will be different, Michelle. It's going to be different right around the world.
Well, just talking about international students, they've provided, of course, an enormous export industry for Australia, some $37.5 billion to the economy in 2018-19 financial year. The virus has all but killed that market, yet the government's been very reluctant to extend much support to the university sector. Do you think this is because they believe there's featherbedding in the sector, or do you think there's also an ideological overlay to this reluctance?
Look, I think it's tempting to ask questions about, you know, whether we'd see the government respond in the same way to other very big export industries, the way they've responded to higher education during this period. I'm not sure that I'd particularly suggest there's an ideological aspect to it. There are limits to what governments can do. Right at the beginning of the pandemic, when we moved into a very isolated working from home, teaching from home, learning from home environment, you know, the government responded by providing some certainty around Commonwealth support for Australian domestic students. That was welcomed by the sector. That was an important $18 billion commitment by the Commonwealth. So we have seen elements of support for the sector, but nowhere near, I think, as extensive as you've pointed out, the importance of this industry to the Australian economy would deserve. But having said that, I think the sector has responded in a remarkably robust way, notwithstanding all of those challenges that we've had to deal with. I know that universities are now beginning to assess the long-term implications of a downturn in international education, a downturn in the sector over the next 2 or 3 years, because this is not a one-year pandemic that might be resolved at some point in 2021. This is something that's going to affect the sector for several years, because the economic recovery overseas, the capacity for students to study internationally, the amount of international mobility, all of that is going to be curtailed and constrained, which means universities are going to have to deal with a very different financial situation over the course of particularly 21, 22, and I suspect 23. And it won't be, we predict, until 2024 that we see recovery back towards 2019 levels. So we do have, I think, a very important set of conversations to have with the Commonwealth about their current jobs-ready graduate reform package, but more broadly about how we can reactivate the international education sector as quickly as we can to assist our universities over the next few years. It's going to be very, very challenging.
Well, just on this point of getting the students back, the South Australian government's taken an initiative to bring in a limited number of students and they'll quarantine and so on. But I noticed there's been a lot of public reaction against that. People have said, well, why are we letting special rules for these students or giving them priority when a lot of Australians can't get back without great difficulty? Do you think if those sort of schemes were implemented on a bigger scale, that public reaction would really become very difficult for the sector to handle, for the government to handle?
Well, I think it's going to be challenging. I understand that reaction. I think we all do. But equally, as we've pointed out, international education is hugely important to Australia. And we can talk the economics, as you've outlined, $38 billion a year. That generates a lot of jobs in a lot of sectors of the Australian economy. So it's very important that we do find ways to reinvigorate the international education sector in Australia. So I think it's important that we look for an opportunity to do that, but we've got to do it safely, and we've got to do it in a way that is guided by the best health advice that's available. And we do have many, many students offshore that have been looking for an opportunity to return to Australia to study or to commence their studies in Australia. This is a very modest trial in South Australia, and it's very much about ensuring that we can prove that this is a safe and a reliable corridor to bring students into Australia safely for them to commence their studies in Australian universities as our universities intensify their on-campus activity. I think then when we see the success of that program, that it will reassure the community. I think we've seen that in New South Wales. The real challenges of Victoria, I think, add an element of complexity there. But certainly in New South Wales and Queensland, elsewhere, we are looking forward to being able to establish trials to bring students in and hopefully demonstrate, I'm sure we can, that that can be done very, very effectively, without risk to the community, and help us to regenerate a very important part of the economy.
Do you think the demand for coming to Australia will drop off, though, in terms of, for example, the Chinese government is obviously very negative towards Australia at the moment, and it has made noises to discourage people to come to study?
We are seeing a lot of data at the moment, information flowing from our agents, recruitment agents who operate right around the world, particularly obviously in Asia, but in all parts of Asia. And certainly there is concern in China from many parents and prospective students about the comments being made by the Chinese government and this continuing challenge politically between Australia and China that is creating anxieties. But we're still seeing relatively high levels of demand for study in Australia. Australia has by any measure, a world-class higher education system. We have a long history of very successfully providing international education for students from around the world. And we've built up a very substantial pool of alumni now that are situated right throughout the world, but particularly through Asia, and those families that have had great connections to Australia, they still want their friends and their family to have an opportunity to study in Australia. Yes, there will be an impact on international education, partly because of geopolitics, that will have an impact, partly because the economies of our region will also be suffering and going through recovery, which means there's going to be less capacity, I think, for some students to have an opportunity to study overseas. One of the reasons you might see new models of international education and partnerships and hybrid models of delivery of high-quality Australian education overseas emerging in the near future. I still believe very strongly that Australia has a great future in international education, but it will take time to recover, and it may not recover to the levels of 2018, 2019 for some time, but there is still, on all the measures we're looking at and all the information we're getting, there's still a high level of demand.
When you talk about hybrid models, what are you referring to here?
Well, the opportunity, we're seeing it now, Michelle. It's very interesting. As we've responded to this crisis, we have many students overseas that are applying for visas, wanting to start studying in Australia. Some of them have visas. They want to get to Australia. They might return or be commencing students. But they're prepared to study offshore while they wait for the opportunity for international travel to be open to them again and to come to Australia. So we are developing online education for students offshore in a way that we had never done on scale in Australia, but we're doing it now. We're also working with partners, our partner institutions. One of the great things about higher ed in Australia over the last 20, 30 years has been we've developed very close relationships with universities in our region. So we have partners. So we can work with them. They can help us to deliver programs offshore using technology for Australian academics and researchers to be able to be involved in that teaching program offshore. So there's a richness to a new form of online international education on scale that I think is going to become much more important to the sector over the course of the next few years. And we're seeing the beginnings of that now. So I think hybrid in the sense that students might be on a campus of a partner university, but yet also being able to receive very interactive, high-quality online education from Australia. So a very interesting model.
This industry's obviously brought many benefits for this country, but it's also brought some costs, hasn't it? Have universities become too dependent on these students? And quite significantly, have they in some cases sold out academic standards for the sake of the industry?
No, I don't believe they have at all. In fact, I think academic integrity and the quality of Australian higher education is recognised around the world. We have a regulatory framework here with TEXA that gives us great confidence that Australian universities are reaching the standards that are expected of us. And I think having a regulator like TEXA is an important part of giving confidence to partners around the world about the quality of higher education in Australia. And it's a tight sector in Australia. We only have a very relatively small number of universities for the size of the Australian population, and then of course taking into account international education. Yes, we have responded to the policy directions of governments for many, many years to cultivate a very strong and enduring international education market for Australia. It's been a very, very successful and actually incredibly rapid development of our second or third largest export industry. And the governments of all political persuasions for a long time have been very, very keen to encourage universities to do that. Are we over-reliant? Well, I think we're seeing some equilibration now because some universities are heavily reliant on international students and the revenue that they bring in. You're seeing this in the United Kingdom as well. You're seeing it in the United States, where universities that have relatively large proportions of international students are obviously experiencing more challenges financially at the moment, and their future is equally challenging in terms of how to respond to that in the medium term. But most Australian universities are adapting to the circumstances. We'll rebuild, we'll have to reshape our institutions in the context of our finances. We're certainly looking to diversify our markets as well, Michelle. So we're not highly dependent on one country, not highly dependent necessarily on China. I know in our case at Western Sydney University, only about 16% of our total student load is international. And that's well under the sector average, which is around that 26 to 28% level. So I think we have a very manageable profile in terms of international education and an opportunity to diversify where our students come from right across the region. So you'll see, I think, very appropriate responses from all Australian universities to the emerging opportunities and challenges in international education in the next 3 or 4 years.
We're seeing universities shedding staff during the pandemic. Do you think that this shedding will be permanent, that they won't be able to rehire such numbers? And do you think that the balance between casual and permanent staff is out of kilter these days?
Well, first of all, In the context of will this be permanent? No, it won't be permanent. It will take time for universities to rebuild their staffing levels because it's dependent on the revenue that we'll receive across the board from both government, from student fees, and from international education. And that will take time to recover. The Jobs Ready Graduates Program and reforms that the Commonwealth are looking to introduce is not bringing a lot of additional funding into the sector, certainly nothing like the downturn in revenue from international students. So we'll see a period of recovery before we go back to the levels we might have seen over the last few years. But it's not permanent, but it will take time to recover, and universities need to adjust their staffing profiles accordingly. I think we'll see 21 and 22 being actually more challenging than 2020. So we may see not just the announcements now that we're seeing from universities about very significant staff reductions, but we might see more of that, in fact, in 2021 and 2022. We might also see, and I think this is a great challenge for Australia, a contraction in our research capability and capacity, because a lot of the revenue we receive from international education in many universities is supporting our research activity, and that's one of the reasons we see, as we saw this week, international rankings showing that we are the third highest ranked system in the world on the basis of the rankings released earlier this week. So from that perspective, we will see contract staff working in research whose contracts can't be renewed because funding is going to be curtailed. We're going to see some pretty dramatic impacts on research. And the Commonwealth, I think, is appreciating that issue. How they respond to it is something that we're waiting to see through the current process. The issue you raise about the balance between, you know, casual staff and contract and continuing staff in universities, casualisation as an issue has been of concern to the sector for some time. I know we've done a lot of work to understand the levels of casualisation and how we can find mechanisms to lower levels of casualisation and provide more certainty to our casual staff. I'm sure that in the next round of enterprise bargaining negotiations, we'll see a great deal of emphasis on new models to support casual staff in our universities. But there's no doubt when you have volatility and in times like this, when universities are facing significant financial constraints, you do need to get the balance right between casual academic staff support and our ongoing core, continuing and limited term staff. So it's a balance for every university in the sector. But I'm looking forward to some discussions around new models that can help us to address casualisation levels.
Have you shed staff?
We reached agreement with the NTU and the CPSU at Western Sydney so that this year we won't be shedding staff. We had a great response to variations to our enterprise agreements with the support of the local union branches. So that's enabled us to navigate 2020 quite successfully. But 2021 will be different and we'll be in discussion with the unions and staff in the near future about changes to our staffing profile next year. And yes, I've been very public with colleagues that we will need to make changes because next year, against our forecast budget, we'll be down about $140 million in revenue in 2021 and more in 2022 in our current projection. So you do need to adjust to those sort of circumstances.
So your staff have taken a pay cut to keep jobs?
Well, our staff agreed to help us with cash flow. So they agreed to take additional leave, to buy, if you like, additional leave, to bank additional leave. That gives us a cash benefit this year. And then staff can take that additional leave over the next 5 years or cash it out at the end of 5 years. So it's like a deferred saving of some of their salary and we get the benefit of it in 2020. So it's a banked additional leave scheme and we mandated some additional leave to assist the university to reduce its leave liabilities, again, to help us with cash flow in 2020.
Let's turn to the legislation to restructure university fees. The government has just released its draft legislation. This is aimed at producing more job-ready graduates, and the changes are designed to steer students towards STEM fields, IT, teaching, nursing and the like, while steering them away from the humanities and law. What's the higher education sector response to this? There's been a fair bit of criticism. What do you think? And is the sector trying to negotiate changes?
Well, first of all, the sector is engaged with the Commonwealth, with the government, with the department about a number of aspects of the JRG reform package. And I know there are elements of it that we're certainly concerned about at Western Sydney. There are some very positive elements to the package. Let's be, you know, fair about it. Indexation, growth places, support for industry linkages, regional, rural, remote support, additional support for Indigenous students. There's been, I think, a very appropriate response to the Naptheyne review, for example, in this package, as well as recognising the fact that we're going to move into a period by virtue of the pandemic, the downturn in the economy, where we'll see greater demand for higher education. So we'll need to have a system for the first time in several years capable of funded growth. And elements of the package support that. But of course, it's a complex package and we need to work through some of the challenging elements of it. And this morning I was listening to some of the business peak bodies talking about their concerns with the package, particularly around the levels of help debt that are changing across the various discipline clusters in this package. More expensive for students to study humanities and less so for the STEM and health disciplines. And that's a particular strategy of government, particularly to maintain the overall funding available to the sector, a greater level of reliance on students for the overall funding package, but also to try and incentivize students into STEM by lowering the help debt. I think that is an area that needs more attention. I have doubts that those sort of changes in help will actually drive student behavior. I don't think the evidence suggests that it will. I think there's a sensible way of resetting those levels to have less impact on the humanities and social sciences, and also to recognize that if we reduce the help levels for students in STEM, and you look at the total package of funding, that will reduce funding in universities for those disciplines. And that's sort of counterintuitive to a government that wants to drive the STEM and the health disciplines. I think there's an area there we need to engage very, very seriously with government about. And in our case, of course, there are other changes to the way the package supports campuses that are in what are called low growth or high growth metropolitan areas, the impact that has on the opportunity to meet demand in our region over the next few years. And of course, the move to support more regional, remote, rural students and Indigenous students is at the expense of low SES support. So that balance, I think, is another area we are engaged with government about. So in summary, Michelle, yes, there are some elements that really do need to have some serious attention from the Commonwealth. There are elements of the package that we applaud. Overall, it's not a great deal of additional resource into the sector, so it's not going to compensate for the downturn in international education. But we need to keep engaging with the Commonwealth to see if we can convince them, or the crossbenchers, that there are elements of the package that maintain the integrity of the intent of the Commonwealth, but at the same time, I think, make the package less likely to give volatility to a sector that's recovering from a pandemic.
So the Nationals want changes to the bill on the grounds that they say it disadvantages regional communities. They want courses such as social work and those mental health and similar disciplines around the health area taken out of the high fee band, saying that COVID increases the need for these sort of workers in the country areas. Do you think that's a sound argument?
Well, I do think that, as I said a moment ago, that we need to have the government reconsider the amount of change. You know, in some cases, help levels dropping by 62%, in other cases, growing by 113%. That's a great deal of change across very, very significant areas of activity for universities, and it would have implications in regional Australia. The argument that I know the Innovative Research Universities group is putting, that we're a part of, that we need to look at a rebalancing of those areas is important. And I think the Nationals have picked up on an element of that with some very, very important discipline areas in regional Australia, very important discipline areas in metropolitan Australia. And we don't know yet whether there will be a significant disadvantage to those students and perhaps dissuade them from studying those disciplines. And that will affect the availability of those services in regional as well as metropolitan Australia. That's still to be tested, I think. But nevertheless, lumbering those disciplines with high levels of debt, given we need them to emerge and to be able to contribute to the growing health needs of our communities in the future, seems to be counterproductive. Because let's face it, post-COVID, we're going to need health professionals across a broad range of allied health, social work and social science disciplines to support psychology, to support the recovery of our communities. Now's not the time to make it more difficult to do that.
The government's also proposing policies to crack down on students who fail too many subjects. Those who fail more than half their subjects would be excluded from Commonwealth support, is the thought. What systems are in place currently to limit subject failure, and would such a policy as the Commonwealth's proposing really disadvantage students, particularly in a campus like yours, where a lot of them come from lower socioeconomic backgrounds?
This is a very interesting policy move by the Commonwealth. In a sense, until we saw the exposure draft of the legislation, we weren't aware it was coming. Look, across the sector on the figures that I've seen, there's a very small group of students that would be affected by this. But nevertheless, on the data I'm seeing, regional students, Indigenous students, and students from low SES backgrounds are likely to be the ones most impacted. And it's often the case, particularly in first year, students moving from a regional location or from an educationally disadvantaged background coming to university, that can be a very confronting experience, and their first year results may not be very strong. We have, all universities, and this has been something we've developed over decades, we have great processes in place. First of all, to identify at-risk students, to assist them early, when there are early signs that they might be challenged by the academic program they're in, to both at a pastoral level and an academic level, to intervene to assist them. And a whole range of ways we work with students to reduce their study load, to provide them with academic support, to scaffold around their learning in a variety of ways to assist them to be successful. We want students to be successful. We are very conscious of retention and the need to retain our students, and importantly, the scrutiny that often occurs around levels of attrition in Australian universities. And to address that, let's find ways to support our students through. And in some cases, those students need to take leave and return at some point in the future. In some cases, higher education is not for them. But they're very few in number. We have great systems across the entire sector to support those students. I believe this is an issue that shouldn't be one of legislation. I think if the minister is concerned about it, as he is, and he's articulated that publicly, this is a matter that should be referred to TEXA. We have a quality regulator. We have standards. If the government wishes to undertake more work on this, then they should refer it to TEXA and handle it through the regulator and the regulatory framework rather than the legislative framework, in my view.
Now, just finally, a lot of students who are finishing their schooling this year, of course, are naturally very anxious about the future. How are graduating high school students being dealt with by the universities, by your university in particular, and what sort of reassurances can you give?
Michelle, I think this is a very important area for all universities at the moment because we're conscious of the impact the pandemic has had on this year's Year 12 cohort, and for that matter, this year's Year 11 cohort, and you can continue on, but particularly the Year 12 cohort. So I know that every university is looking at their admissions pathways and how we can ensure that students coming through this year's Year 12 have every opportunity, even if they've had a disrupted Year 12, as many of them have, every opportunity to come into university next year. And let's also recognise the fact that we're likely to see very few students taking a gap year. So we'll see more students next year wanting to start higher education. Economy will still be depressed. There won't be an opportunity to travel for a gap year. We'll need to respond to that demand level and provide the support around students coming from that disadvantaged background. So in our case, and some other universities, we're looking at Year 11 results for this year's Year 12 to see how we can take that into account. We want them to finish their HSC. Will take their Year 11 results into account and help to give us guidance about their capacity to undertake a higher education. And in our case, we're also giving access to our career development technology that we've developed to help students begin to think about their futures even as they wait to enter university next year. And we'll be doing a lot of remedial support work in the early part of 2021 to try and provide some additional support to those students who want to take advantage of it, and other universities are doing very, very similar things. So very conscious of the challenge, Michelle, but I think universities are very focused on finding pathways, and that should be reassuring, I think, to parents and to students going through a very critical phase of Year 12 right at the moment.
Very difficult times. Thank you, Barney Glover, for sharing your insights. And that's all from today's Politics podcast. Thank you to my producer, Tom Glassy. We'll be back with another interview soon, but goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevere. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.